In November 2014, Mother Jones reporter Shane Bauer went undercover as a prison guard at the notoriously violent Wynn Correctional Center in Winfield, Louisiana. His employers, the Corrections Corporation of America, were so eager to recruit that they failed to discover he was a journalist through their background check. Over 4 months at the prison, Shane dutifully took notes. He witnessed all manner of horrors. Men locked into knife fights, sexual assaults, beatings, fellow guards turning a blind eye to or even participating in the prison's black market economy. And on several harrowing occasions, Shane feared his superiors had learned his true purpose there. But perhaps the most alarming element of his experience was the transformation he felt within. Shane entered the prison with the intention of being a passive observer, a laid-back guard, never forgetting his role as a reporter. But toward the end, he became paranoid, at times even felt vindictive toward the prisoners. He started drinking more. He wanted to get in fights. He had nightmares. And the changes scared him. Shane himself had been prisoner once. In 2009, he spent more than a year in an Iranian prison during his time as a journalist based in Syria. Today, he's here to tell us what it felt like to change from captive to captor and work for one of the largest private prison companies in the country. It's an extraordinary, brave story, and we're thrilled he's here to tell us about it. Shane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired the idea? I mean, it's not every day that an investigative reporter decides to go undercover. How did you and Mother Jones decide that this was a scenario where that was called for?
Well, I had been working on criminal justice and prisons in particular for a few years. And, you know, it's very clear to anybody who writes about prisons that there are major obstacles to getting information and stories out of prison. If you get inside of a prison, it's generally for a carefully scripted tour. It's notoriously difficult to get information even through public records or requests. And the other way is to correspond or reach out to prisoners, but even then it's hard to verify their claims. And with private prisons in particular, there's even greater issues around secrecy. Public records laws do not apply to private prisons in the same way as they do to public prisons. These are private companies, so they're not public institutions. So it's even harder to really know what life is like inside. And we have 2.2 million people behind bars in the United States. I mean, this is not a small issue. This is of grave importance. And it's also something that's being discussed a lot publicly and politically. And I and my editors felt that it was worth putting an application and seeing what happened. And frankly, I didn't think anything was going to happen, but it was like, well, this is going to take an hour. Fill out an application on their website, filled it out honestly using my real name and personal information. And a couple weeks later, I was getting calls from prisons around the country.
That's one of the fascinating first elements of your story, is that it just seemed remarkably easy to get the job. Were you struck by that?
Yeah, I mean, I was nervous about these interviews. I mean, every step of the process was pretty nerve-wracking, but, you know, I submitted an application, I was getting calls, so I was like, okay, how do I deal with this? The ground rule is always that I never lie, and I didn't have to worry about anything. I mean, it was almost as if they were trying to sell the job to me during the interviews sometimes. The person that I talked to in Louisiana was telling me that they only pay $9 an hour, but if I like to hunt and fish, you know, there's good hunting and fishing around there. And she told me that a lot of people around there squirrel hunt, so that was something I could do with my spare time.
And just to tease out the scene a little bit more for us, so you're sitting at home, presumably your wife is around for some of these conversations. You're a reporter. You're applying for jobs at private prisons across the country, and it's almost like they're recruiting you. I mean, how did that feel?
I mean, it was exciting in a way. It was just an idea, and very quickly it was becoming reality. And I didn't even really let myself think too much about it initially, because I just thought, well, if they Google my name, that's the end. You know, they're going to see that I'm a reporter, that I've written about prison. And but once the ball started rolling, then it was like, wow, this might happen. I might be moving who knows where soon. and be really inside of a prison. And I was definitely excited about that prospect.
And presumably they never did Google you. They, from what you describe in the story, were pretty excited about your decision to accept a job. And the next thing you know, you're moving to Louisiana.
Right. Yeah.
Was there a moment when you really felt like this wild idea was finally becoming a reality? And if so, what were you feeling in that moment?
There were several moments like that. I mean, just the first time I drove through Winfield, it was like I felt really far from home. I mean, it was this small, really run-down town, and it was hard to imagine living around there. Then I basically just drove through the town and drove to the next town, which is a town called Natchitoches, and liked that town a little better, and also liked that it was kind of farther from the prison, so I would minimize my chances of running into coworkers when I was off duty. And just being there was pretty, I don't know, nerve-wracking. I just felt like suddenly I was this fish out of water, and I was about to jump into something huge. And then certainly entering the prison for the first time, the first time I went in the prison was when I took that drug test, and I was just in the prison for a half hour, but when I left, I was so amped up. I mean, it was like I couldn't imagine being in there all day. It just had this feeling like I was this infiltrator, and I was inside, and not just inside anything, but inside of a prison, you know. So I didn't know what would happen if they found out, you know, that I was a journalist. And I had no idea what the job was going to be like or anything.
And you don't begin to find out, really, until the training starts. And the training, to my mind, it does not seem as though the training really prepares somebody for the job that you were entering. Describe it for us.
I went through 4 weeks of training, and this wasn't 4 weeks of training every day. There were a lot of days that the other cadets and I would literally just sit there, and nobody was there to teach us, so we would just run the clock. You know, we learned about, you know, 1 hour, 2 hour CPR class. We'd watch videos about use of force. We'd get lectures about inmate manipulation. Well, on my second day of training, we were learning about use of force, and a guard who was running the class, he asked us what we'd do if we saw two inmates stabbing each other. And he said that all we were required to do was to verbally tell them to stop, and to call it in over the radio so that backup could come. We didn't have, you know, weapons, no pepper spray or a billy club or anything like that. And he said to us, you do not get paid enough to get in the middle of it. Our job is to go home at the end of the day, and if these fools want to cut each other up, happy cutting.
And this whole time you're serving this dual function of, one, trying to appear that you're genuinely interested in becoming a prison guard, and two, reporting on the process. How did you manage to accomplish both of those things? I mean, you write about how you were sneaking off to take notes. What did that feel like?
Well, during training, it was easy because we're in class, so I could just sit and write notes the whole time. Although that did make me stand out because I was the only person taking notes. So it was almost like I was being too interested in being a guard, and it was kind of making me stand out. I would ask questions a lot in class. But once I actually started on the job, it was different. You know, I had a notebook in my pocket that I could jot things down in. And prisoners later, after I left, one prisoner told me that he noticed that a lot, and that it was raising suspicions amongst some of the inmates.
Right, and I want to get to that moment later, but even earlier than that, there was a superior officer in the course of the training that seemed suspicious of you. Can you describe that moment?
Yeah, he was teaching a class, and I think that was actually a class on inmate management. And throughout his lecture, he kept asking me what my name was. He would ask me, and then he would forget, and he'd ask me again. And then he wrote my name up on the board eventually, so he couldn't forget it. And then at the end of his class, he turned to me and said, I act like I don't know what your name is, but I do know what your name is. I play games just like they play games. And I was sure in that moment that he knew what I was up to. And I went home, and I was freaked out the whole night. I thought he was just toying with me, but he wasn't. Nothing came of it.
So talk about the first few days on the floor and actually working as a prison guard?
Well, my first day actually fully on the job, I was stationed on suicide watch. And suicide watch is in the segregation unit. It's called Cypress Unit. So that's a unit where prisoners who are being disciplined get sent to. They're put in 8-by-8-foot cells, usually with one other inmate, and they only leave for an occasional shower and maybe to go to a cage outside for an hour, although often that didn't happen. And inside this unit, there is suicide watch. So if a prisoner says that he is suicidal, he's put here in a cell alone. He's in solitary confinement. He has no clothes. He's in the cell naked except for a tear-proof blanket. He doesn't have a mattress. He really is allowed nothing in his cell, and he even gets worse food than the rest of the prisoners. They would get what they called a suicide bag, which was a brown bag lunch with a sandwich. They called it a mystery meat sandwich and a peanut butter sandwich and some carrot sticks and celery sticks. The nutritional value, the calories of which fell below USDA recommended standards. So I was stationed here. Basically, I was supposed to observe a prisoner. There's no mental health staff there. It's just one or two guards watching the inmates on suicide watch, and I would just have to note what they were doing every 15 minutes. And it was really tense. I mean, the prisoner I was watching, they didn't want me sitting there. One of them said he's going to jump off his bed and break his neck, he also told me he's having mental health emergencies, which I reported, but a psychiatrist didn't show up for 6 hours later. Another prisoner sat and stared and masturbated at me for the whole time I was there, practically. And that was my first day on the job. And it was like, I mean, at that moment, I couldn't really see myself doing that every day. I was later stationed in a unit called ASH Unit. That's where I worked almost the entire time that I was at Wynn. ASH Unit was basically had 350 or so prisoners housed in 8 dorms. So they're just open dorms with about 44 men in them. And I worked there with one other floor officer. So it was me and him. You know, we were basically the interface with the prison population. And, you know, we'd let them out to eat, sometimes to go to the small recreation yard next to the unit, or to go out to, you know, their programs and things like that. But there was this kind of constant feeling of chaos and frustration. Programs got canceled regularly. Prisoners would get frustrated about that. They'd get angry. And it was really hard to maintain any control. I mean, I learned really quickly that the prisoners saw the guards at CCA as a joke. I would ask them about how it compared to other prisons they'd been to, and they would tell me that at Wynn there was no structure compared to the other places, no security compared to the other places. There was less programs, and so there wasn't much kind of respect for the staff.
Yeah, so reading the story, I mean, it seems clear that you enter the prison at a time of crisis. I mean, what precipitated that, and how did it influence the job?
I mean, while I was in training, there was an escape. A man, in the middle of the day, climbed over the fence in view of the guard towers and ran into the woods. Nobody saw him, partially because there's no guards in the towers anymore. The company had removed those posts and replaced them with cameras, presumably to save money. And people didn't even know that he had escaped for a few hours. So that drew a lot of attention from the state. And there were also a lot of stabbings. I witnessed stabbings myself, saw people get beaten. There were multiple stabbings just in 1 week. And it had this sense of getting out of control. The prison was locked down several times while I was there, which always raised the frustration level of the prisoners because they would just be stuck in their dorms. There was one time that they had been on lockdown after a rash of stabbings for 11 days, I think, and the prisoners in my unit threatened to riot. The corporation sent in what is called a SWAT team. It's a SWAT-like tactical team. It brought it in from its prisons around the country to try to take control, and they basically swept through the prison searching for anything they could find. There was a couple of days that 70 homemade knives were found in the prison. Over a two-month period, I discovered later, after I left from, you know, records requests with the Department of Corrections, over 2 months while I was there, there were around 200 weapons found at Wynn, and that is 23 times more than Angola prison, which is the state's maximum security prison.
Wow. Yeah, it's figures like that that really kind of take your breath away, but there's also some scenes that are just as frightening. You witness two guys in the midst of a knife fight and see one of them stab the other in the neck, and you and this other guard are basically asking them to stop, as you're instructed to do. I mean, what, take us into that moment and what was going through your mind as you were watching this?
Well, that moment was kind of illuminating for me because I remember years ago seeing a video that leaked from a CCA prison in Idaho where a prisoner is stabbing another prison a lot, and you see a guard standing in the distance, and I think he was yelling, but he wasn't getting in the middle of it. And, you know, when I saw that, I thought, like, how callous is this person just standing and watching this stabbing? And then I went through training and saw that we were taught that, but when I really saw this stabbing myself, I just had the sense like there's nothing I could do. You know, we weren't given anything that would enable us to get in the middle of something like that. So we're just standing there on the other side of the bars telling them to stop. And, I mean, this went on for several minutes. These two guys were grappling with shanks in their hands, and there's a bunch of prisoners standing around watching, but it's eerily quiet. There's just these guys kind of tussling. It felt really mundane in a lot of ways and kind of commonplace. It really drove that home when I saw it.
You describe this kind of fascinating turning point in the story where you become a much more aggressive and vigilant guard. What was it like to go through that transformation?
It was difficult. There was one point, I think maybe the point you're referring to, that I kind of snapped at somebody and just start shouting at this guy. You know, I noticed after a while that when new guards would start, there would be some prisoners that would find a point of vulnerability. And so something that would happen with me is that some prisoners would make kind of sexual comments to me. They would catcall me. And, you know, I would try to ignore it. But there was one day that it just really got to me. And I just start screaming at this guy and really lost my temper. And said some things that I was really embarrassed about later, and once I kind of cooled off. And that was kind of, in some ways, the beginning of a process where I started seeing myself become somebody else, and at least when I was working inside. And I would go home, and a lot of times on my drive home, I was feeling ashamed, you know, and I was always trying to figure out how to do it differently, but it just felt like this slippery slope that I just kept going down, that started with just being more firm, and then I had kind of conflicts with people that became battles, and then, you know, I just started to develop this paranoia about, you know, thinking that people were taking advantage of me in ways that probably had, doing things that probably had nothing to do with me. But, you know, I just always had this feeling like I wasn't really safe, and it was hard to feel that way in there. So I was always trying to figure out how to do that, and there's no real way to be myself in that role.
Right. You describe in the story how you begin to relish the authority, that you almost looked forward in a way to seeing people have to bow to your control. Yelling at them becomes kind of a relief. You write about how at one point you hoped almost or looked forward to a unit being tear gassed. What was it like to feel that change in you?
There's just a sense, such a rising sense of tension within me the longer I worked there, that I always felt like I needed a release. And you know, I found myself some days coming into work obsessed with certain conflicts, certain prisoners that I was having issues with, and I became obsessed with how to win those battles. And sometimes that involved sending them away to segregation. And there was this idea that if I would win these battles, that eventually people wouldn't give me trouble anymore. But that never really happened.
And I want to home in on segregation for a moment, because you yourself have been held captive. You were imprisoned for more than a year in Iran when you were a journalist based in Syria, and you spent quite a bit of that time in solitary. And now here you are pulling people out of general population and sending them into segregation. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, I spent 4 months in solitary confinement myself, and then another 22 months basically in a cell with another person, but with very little interaction with people outside of that. And that was something that had a really profound impact on me, not only then, but after. It took me a long time to recover from that. And, you know, that is something that I still grapple with when I think about my time at Wynn, you know, that I sent people, or that people were sent as a result of my disciplinary reports or something, to segregation. It's not something that I think should be taken lightly. I mean, the United Nations has said that solitary confinement over a period of 10 days could constitute torture. But at the same time, I know that in the context I was in, there were no other options. You hear guards talk about this a lot, and this really is a much bigger issue than the individuals working in the place. It's a systemic problem. It's either, you know, you can take phone privileges or canteen privileges away, which for a lot of people really doesn't matter, or you send them to this place that literally was called, that people told me was called the dungeon. You know, the first time I went in there, they said, "Welcome to the hellhole. Welcome to the dungeon." But yeah, I mean, when I'm working in this general population unit and somebody gives me a death threat or threatens to attack me, I don't know what else to do. My priority is to stay safe in that situation. And when somebody seems to be a serious threat to me, I want to get rid of them as soon as possible. And that was how it was done there.
One thing that I think many investigative journalists struggle with is that some of the horrific things that we see make for great stories. They're revelations that are powerful, but at the same time, they're profoundly depressing. And you must have felt that in an even more acute way, considering that you'd experienced some of it yourself as a former prisoner. So can you kind of walk us through what was happening for you internally over the course of these 4 months?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard for me really to see the extent of it until I left. I was aware of how I was changing in the prison and how I was relating to prisoners differently and how I was kind of turning off, you know, emotionally in order to cope with the situation. My wife came a couple of times for extended visits in Louisiana, and on her second time down, she told me, "You're changing." And I was having nightmares, you know, at night. I was making sounds in my sleep, and, you know, that was really apparent to her and also to my colleague, James West, who came down to shoot video. And I was really aware that I could not really ever relax. I mean, I would try to decompress when I got off, but there was never enough time to do that. And I noticed myself start drinking more, the kind of things that is really common for guards in general. I noticed myself sometimes wishing that somebody would spark a fight with me so I could just get out some of that pent-up aggression. But it wasn't until I left that I really saw how far down that rabbit hole I'd gone. I mean, I was basically in the prison for 12 hours a day. There was long stretches of 3-4 days, sometimes 5 days, that I would be there for 12 hours, drive home, eat, sleep, get up, go back. And there wasn't a lot of time for reflection on my own process. It was more spending a lot of energy figuring out how to make it in the job, how to be a guard, and then also be paying attention to the things I'm seeing, make sure that I'm getting it down for the story. So it was hard to really be on top of all of the emotional stuff that was going on as well.
And whatever was happening internally, externally, you obviously played the role rather well. You were offered a promotion, and it seemed as though there was a moment of satisfaction in that.
Yeah, I mean, it was strange. First time I had an evaluation, it was a very positive evaluation by my supervisor. He said I should think about promoting, and it was like I had this feeling like, oh, I'm doing a good job. I was already so deep in the job that it was kind of, you know, I wasn't removed from it anymore. It was hard to maintain that kind of critical distance, like, oh, I'm doing a good job. Everybody likes to be told they're doing a good job. I mean, it was also bizarre to me. I mean, I had only been there for a couple of months, and I was already being offered a promotion. And that, to me, said a lot about the place. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was just kind of doing what I had to do. I wasn't some kind of stellar officer or anything like that. But, you know, this is in the context of a lot of guards that have very low morale and are basically doing the bare minimum. I mean, my work partner, Dave Bakel, said to me, I feel like I'm nothing but a body to this company, you know, and I think that was a common feeling. He also said to me, I wish an investigative reporter would come and investigate this prison.
Right. Yeah, what went through your mind when he said that?
I really wish I could have told him, but it was surprise. I mean, it wasn't surprising. I mean, I already was really familiar with his frustrations and other people's frustrations, but that really made me feel like I was harboring a pretty big secret from him.
So let's talk about kind of the final weeks there. I mean, just after your promotion, the ruse goes up. What happens? How were you found out?
I never took a promotion. I was just named for promotion. And I was actually deciding at that time whether I should stay or not. I mean, I knew that psychologically it probably was not good for me to stay there much longer. I was really tired of the job, really exhausted. But I was also curious for the story to see where that would lead if I accepted a promotion, what other things I would see if I would have more access. But it turned out that the decision was made for me because my colleague, James West, who had come down to shoot video for the story one night after we were going around the town, getting images of the town, I went home to go to sleep because I had to work the next day. And he went near the prison to take some photos, some nighttime shots of the prison. And he was spotted by a patrol van, and he was eventually arrested by the sheriff's department. And he was in jail for 24 hours. As soon as I found out that night, I got a hold of my editors right away. We got our lawyers on it, tried to get him out as soon as possible. But he was questioned by not only sheriffs, but state police and Homeland Security people. He's Australian himself. And one of the guys said to him something like, I don't care that guy works in the prison. They were saying, I don't care if you're writing about CCA. Some of them said they don't like CCA. But they never said my name, but it kind of gave James the impression that they found out about me.
So you get out of Dodge pretty abruptly after that.
Yeah. As soon as he got out, we basically packed up the apartment and drove straight to Texas. And I called in and resigned from Dallas.
And then you start contacting some of the people that you worked with and some of the inmates, and tell us about their reaction.
Well, I reached out to everybody who is mentioned in the story, and most people in the story I use pseudonyms for, unless they gave me permission to use their names, but I did try to get in touch with all of them. A lot of them didn't respond, some did, and of the ones that I did speak to, they were generally excited about the story and were looking forward to seeing it. I spoke to a high-level officer who was assistant chief of security, who gave me a lot of information and details about what happened after I left. And I ended up getting back in touch with my work partner, Dave Bakel, and a prisoner who I write about in this story a lot, who I call Corner Store. And he actually was released after I left. So I went back to Louisiana with James West and a producer from Reveal, who was working on a radio piece. And we met a couple of the guards that I worked with and Corner Store as well.
And you eventually, as one does in the reporting process, confront CCA itself and the Department of Corrections. And what was that exchange like?
I reached out to CCA asking them for an in-person interview, and they declined. I never actually spoke to anybody. Our exchanges were all through email. I sent them over 150 questions, some giving them a chance to respond to some things that show up in the story, some just trying to get other information, some checking facts. And, you know, it was kind of a long back and forth. They also, after I left, contacted us through a lawyer telling Mother Jones that if it published a story by me, there could be legal consequences. The Department of Corrections, on the other hand, you know, I also was submitting public records requests from them, and that process took a very long time. But in the end, shortly before we sent the story off, the actual magazine to get printed, they sent me correspondence between them and CCA that started while I was working there, basically showing that they were kind of after CCA for a lot of issues. They had a lot of complaints that echoed a lot of the findings in my story. They were complaining of there not being enough security staff, mental health staff, medical staff, the condition of the buildings. They said that they were in a state of disrepair. And I even learned things that I didn't know in there, like that they said that CCA had been charging prisoners for state-issued toilet paper and toothpaste and charging them to clip their nails. You know, that it was interesting to get that in the last moment. Our fact checkers were very relieved to see that because it corroborated the things that I've been writing about already.
And eventually, CCA loses its contract, correct?
CCA gave up its contract just 2 or 3 weeks after I left. It came out publicly that I had been working there. There was some local coverage and then some national coverage of James's arrest and the fact that I had been working there and that I was a reporter for Mother Jones. Just a few weeks after that, they gave up their contract. They have run this prison since the early 90s. And the only thing that they said publicly about why they gave it up was they told their shareholders that Wynn was not making enough money. They ran the prison until October, and then it was taken over by a new company called LaSalle, which is a Louisiana-based private prison company.
Final question. Is there a key takeaway that you would like people to have from reading this?
Well, my experience at Wynn, in so many ways, it was clear, more than I really anticipated, the impact of how conditions were affected by the profit motive of this private prison company. They basically, you know, have to deal with this contradiction where they are required to provide care and safety and security to prisoners. They also are obligated to turn a profit. Their stocks are traded on Wall Street, and there is always going to be a tension there. One of the main ways that CCA saves money is in staffing. 60% of the cost of running their prisons is in staffing. So they paid much lower than the state paid its guards. They also didn't fill their positions, even to the bare minimum of what the contract required. And that has a serious impact. I saw the ways that that impacted conditions in the prison in terms of safety, in terms of medical care, in terms of mental health care, and also safety of the surrounding community. I mean, somebody escaped while I was there. And, you know, there's 131,000 people in private prisons right now in the United States, so this is not an issue that's limited to this one prison.
Well, it's a really extraordinary effort and story, and I commend you for it, and want to thank you for coming onto the program to tell us about it.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's ProPublica podcast. Please join us again next week.